Claudia Kozinets, and I'm the chair of the epidemiology section. And Robin Taylor Wilson is the chair-elect. Robin, would you like to stand, please? And we both welcome you to the section's award session. The section is in its 81st year as a section of the American Public Health Association. We are very proud of its history and the individuals who have served and supported the section before us. During this session, we are going to take time to honor three of the best and accomplished epidemiologists. Epidemiologists known to all of us, Snow, Lilienfeld, and Frost, have set the stage for our awards recipients' research, public health service, teaching. So sit back, absorb the stories, the memories about all of our awardees today. I also want to announce the session following right here in this room, which will be in tribute to student members of the section. There will be three awards given to our students on the basis of the abstracts that they submitted this year to the annual meeting. And then following that session, we will have a reception, a short walk back to the convention center in the Corbell Ballroom 4D. And one more announcement. Tomorrow evening, please join us again as we sort of wrap up our year with a social that will take place at Marlowe's at 7 p.m. Tomorrow. You can get more information both on the section and on our socials, all of our events at our booth. Please come visit us at our booth for some goodies and giveaways and all sorts of neat information on our section. And so Robin Taylor Wilson is going to continue with our ceremony today, and we'll go from there.
Thank you, Claudia. And I just want to welcome everyone here. It's really wonderful to see you all, see returning faces, see new faces. And again, I hope you will come to our social. And if you don't come introduce yourself, I will come introduce myself to you. This portion of the awards session today, I have the honor of recognizing our 40 and 50-year members. We are proud to recognize the leadership and enduring commitment to public health and epidemiology by our 40th and 50-year members. And this year, our 50th year APHA members are Dr. William S. Burnett, Dr. James Chin, Dr. Maureen M. Henderson, Dr. Donald W. Sample, and our 40th anniversary members, Dr. Michelle Benenson, Dr. Lewis Howard Rott, Dr. Beatrice J. Selwyn, and Dr. Elizabeth Woodard. And do we have, how many members, do we have any members here that are 40-year members, beyond 40 years, even if this isn't your anniversary? Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Robin. We're so appreciative of our sustaining members. And as we discussed during one of our business meetings last evening, you all add to the diversity of the section. And that came up as one of the primary strengths of the epidemiology section of APHA was the diversity of our members. And so thank you for adding to our strength. Now I must regrettably preface the next section of this program and inform you that Dr. Heyman sends his sincere regrets, but due to physician orders, he's required to stay at home. Okay. The John Snow Award recognizes an outstanding epidemiologist for excellence in epidemiologic practice or research. Such excellence is exemplified by the section's past award recipients listed behind me. So just take a few seconds to look at that distinguished list of individuals, with a few of them gracing our presence here today. Our section's logo, also behind me, depicts a pump handle. This handle is known as the John Snow pump handle. But before I introduce our awardee, I invite Dr. Nigel Carter to say a few words about the John Snow Society, which in collaboration with our section sponsors this award and also has allowed us to use the pump handle as part of our logo. Dr. Carter?
Thank you very much for your welcome. I'm the treasurer of the Royal Society of Public Health, which, whilst a very new body, only formed just over 2 years ago now, was actually formed by an amalgamation of two of the oldest bodies in public health in the UK, which have their origins right back to John Snow and the famous pump handle. And indeed, we were for very many years custodians of that pump handle, although it now resides with the chartered CIEH in the UK rather than with ourselves. So in 2008, the Royal Society for the Promotion of Health and the Royal Institute of Public Health combined their history and strength for a new body for the 21st century. And at the point in which they actually combined between them, they've got over 300 years history of promoting public health right back in the origins, which you celebrate in your symbol. So it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation. And I'm delighted to present the award on behalf of the John Snow Society, which sits within the Royal Society for Public Health.
So let me continue with a little bit of background on Dr. Hammond. His research interests focus on chronic disease epidemiology and prevention, with special emphasis on diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and aging in minority populations. I expect most of intro classes on epidemiology incorporate Dr. Hammond's research on the epidemiology of diabetes in the Pima Indians. I know when I think back to my courses, it certainly is a glimmer of a memory for me. The astonishing 19-fold greater incidence of diabetes in the Pima population compared to a predominantly white population reported in the AJE article in 1978 is just one of the many articles of this seminal research. Dr. Hammond's skill at population-based research is further exemplified with his research utilizing the Colorado IDDM registry and the work resulting from the San Luis Valley Diabetes Study. We are reminded of Dr. Hammond's John Snow-like qualities when reviewing his study on nitrate levels in community drinking waters and the risk of IDDM. This evening, Dr. Hammond and his colleagues will celebrate, Dr. Hammond from his home, his colleagues will celebrate the Colorado School of Public Health's newly awarded accreditation. Dr. Hammond is the founding dean of that school. And so let's. And so the epidemiology section of APHA is proud to add to that celebration by awarding Dr. Heyman with the 2010 John Snow Award. And here today for Dr. Heyman is Dr. Tim Byrne, and will be reading, reading Dr. Heyman's words from his iPhone, which I hope was adequately charged. There we go. Great.
I'm glad to be here to read this message from Dick Heyman. Dick actually recruited me here 15 years ago within the School of Medicine, where we worked in the Preventive Medicine Department. And over the past 10 years, we've been working to create the School of Public Health, which we did create 2 years ago and was accredited 2 weeks ago. So this is a big weekend for Dick to host the APHA meeting here in Denver to celebrate our new school's accreditation. And I know he's terrifically honored to receive this award. So I'm happy to share this with you. I think, hold on. Brought up the wrong message. Colleagues in the APHA epidemiology section, again, I'm channeling for Dick. My deepest apologies for being unable to join you in person to accept this prestigious award. It's truly an honor and a privilege to be selected for the John Snow Award. I never had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Snow, though I've shared a pint in the pub named after him in London, as many of us have had. I had the pleasure of working with other Snow Award recipients over the years, including Abe Lilienfeld, the first Snow Awardee, who was my mentor at Johns Hopkins many years ago. I have had a wonderful career studying the epidemiology of diabetes, both in youth and in adults. As our knowledge of the risk factors for adult onset diabetes has expanded, I've had the good fortune to move from observational to interventional epidemiology as a primary prevention trial. He's referring to the diabetes prevention trial, and with a large number of wonderful colleagues. And I've been able to show that type 2 diabetes could be prevented and delayed. The diabetes prevention program was a very successful example of taking epidemiologic population observations into practice, something that does not always work. Unfortunately, at the same time that we have found some approaches to reducing diabetes risk among high-risk adults, we're faced with a huge and growing population of youth and young adults with too many behavioral risk factors, obesity primarily among them. And we're faced with a worldwide epidemic of diabetes that is occurring in developed and developing countries. The rise in the prevalence of type 2 diabetes is partly due to demographic factors outside of our control, such as population aging, but also to better medical therapies that have extended and improved life for persons with diabetes, allowing longer survivorship with resulting higher prevalence. Among youth and among adults with type 1 diabetes, similar advances in therapy have occurred, but the annual risk among many populations is increasing at 3 to 5% per year with little change in sight. These observations require intense investment in long-term epidemiologic studies to begin to understand why risk is increasing. Tackling this diabetes epidemic will take concerted efforts by biologic and population scientists, public health workers, policymakers, and individuals who can be informed of what they can do to reduce their risk. It will take a combination of population and individual approaches to begin to turn the rising tide of diabetes over the next decade, but it must be done. I'm honored that you believe my work and that of my colleagues has started to make a difference. There are many people to thank for working together on this task, since modern epidemiology is a team sport. Time does not allow me to identify everyone, but I would mention in particular Peter Bennett and Abe Lilienfeld, my primary mentors on this journey, and at the University of Colorado, Julie Marshall, Judy Baxter, Donna DeBilia, Marion Rivers, Jill Norris, and John Hokanson, and I'll add Tim Byers. No, I won't. I do cancer epidemiology. All great colleagues who have worked together on multiple aspects of the diabetes program. Thank you again very much for this honor, and I'm very sorry I was unable to be here in person to receive it. Let me just add that Dick is actually going to do fine. He'll be up on his feet soon and back at work doing this great work. So thank you. On behalf of him, thank you very much.
As I mentioned, we have three career awards as tradition of our section, and the next award is the Abraham Lilienfeld Award. And to introduce the recipient is Linda Haslett, who is one of our governing counselors for the epidemiology section. Linda?
Thank you, Claudia. I'm very happy today to stand before you to present the Abraham Lilienfeld Award to a great teacher, mentor, and friend. Dr. Robert McCown is professor and chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics of the Arnold School of Public Health, the University of South Carolina. In addition to an undergraduate degree in chemistry from Furman University, and a Master's of Divinity in Theology from Duke University. He holds a PhD in Philosophical Theology from Duke University and a PhD in Epidemiology from the University of South Carolina. Robert was my first epidemiology teacher back in 1990. Can you believe it has been that long? Which was an introductory course for all public health students at the time. I remember that first day as if it were yesterday. I was sitting in the second row of a large auditorium, and I took 8 pages of notes that day. And it was the first day of an introductory course where you pass out the syllabus and you don't talk about much else. But I managed to take 8 pages of notes, and I, of course, am a type AAA. Sitting next to me were a couple of other type AAA students. And at the end, he pulled out a book and was talking about Jon Snow and the pump. And that was one of the things that he often did. He brought extra materials to class rather than just teaching the basics of the class. And at one point, he looked over his glasses at those of us in the second row and said, "You don't have to write down every word that I say." And we looked up at him like deer in headlights, and promptly continued to write down every word that he said. He loved to bring in comics because he felt that laughter was so important to life in general. One day in class, this was before the internet, he asked, "Who in here reads the newspaper comics?" And no one rose their hand, and he was absolutely shocked that people didn't start their day with the comics because he felt that it was so important to start the day with laughter. However, in addition to his lightheartedness, he felt a very serious responsibility to teach his students proper epidemiologic methodology. He spent much of the time in class focusing on methods, making sure we understood those concepts so that we could apply that to our future work. However, with his very dry sense of humor, he was able to make the task less formidable for our students and, dare I say, more enjoyable. As an example, I considered using 3 classes of birth weight for my outcome variable for my master's thesis, which would have required using polygamous logistic regression. I was sent by my major professor to Robert to clearly understand how to use this method. While I wasn't too keen on the idea and definitely nervous to approach Robert about using the method, however, he made the method understandable and made me feel comfortable about using an extension of logistic, a method that I had used previously. Robert was the individual in the department who really was the go-to person if you wanted to be sure you understood a methods-related issue in epi. He taught over the years 12 courses, often having developed those courses, of which over half were methods-related courses. As a result of his fine teaching skills, he was awarded the James A. Keith Excellence in Teaching Award for the School of Public Health in 1996. He has mentored many doctoral and master's students and served on numerous committees for students as well. Several of his students have gone on to do work in public health, in the public health arena, and I'm only going to talk about 5 because I could go on all day. Dr. Jin Zhang is associate professor at Georgia Southern University and has published over 50 peer-reviewed articles. Dr. Bob German is lead epidemiologist, cancer surveillance branch, division of cancer prevention and control at CDC. Julie Mobley has been a consultant for NGOs here and in Africa. Linda Neff is senior science advisor, division of strategic national stockpile, coordinating office for terrorism preparedness and emergency response, CDC, and Dr. Karen Huebner is managing editor of Epidemiologic Perspectives and Innovations and is an epidemiologist with Environ. And lastly, he is also a very kind and compassionate person. My son had several surgeries and also was diagnosed with autism, all while I was a master's student. Robert took the time to research articles for me and gave me the time off from class that I needed to attend to my son's needs. He truly is a kind and caring professor. Robert is a gifted teacher and truly is deserving of this award. It gives me great pleasure to present the Abraham Lilienfeld Award to my teacher, mentor and friend, Dr. Robert McCown.
Oh, I don't know if I can talk.
Yes, you can.
I am touched and gratified beyond words, but I'm going to try to talk anyway. At least 3 epidemiologic societies present awards named for Abraham Lilienfeld, testimony to the formative and continuing influence of a remarkable epidemiologist and mentor. I was not fortunate to know him, as Dick Hammond was, but his work shaped my understanding of how epidemiology developed and what it should be about. New methods come and go constantly, but his impact has endured because he focused on enduring things. That's something I've tried to do as a teacher also, though it remains for others to judge how successful I've been. In receiving this award, I'm well aware that it's students like Linda and Deb Hurley, who wrote the nomination letter, and others, I see many sitting out here today, who make us as teachers and mentors look good. I cannot begin to guess what they must have said in that letter, but I thank them for overlooking a lot of things to focus on a few things. I'm sure that there's an appropriate epidemiologic term for that kind of bias, but I'll leave that for you to determine. Our students' achievements reflect back to us, whether they like it or not, and whether we deserve it or not. Similarly, our greatest impact is often at times and in ways we hardly notice. During my first stint in graduate school, I went to a lecture by Houston Smith, a major figure in comparative religion. I don't remember a word he said, but I was struck by his demeanor at the reception. He treated every person he met, famous faculty and unknown students, with the same graciousness and intense interest. Even now, close to 40 years later, I remember thinking, that's what I want to be like when I grow up. And I still think that. And I'm still trying, not very successfully at times. Saturday, I will join about 100 others to pay tribute to our high school band director. Now that we have come to realize, some 45 to 50 years later, how very different our lives are because of who he was and what he did for us, even when we weren't aware of it. He taught us the value of discipline, hard work, and commitment to excellence in practice and performance. At the same time, he taught us the joy of great music and collegiality, along with compassion and care for each other and for what we were doing. Remarkable lessons for a ragtag bunch of kids from a poor cotton mill town in South Carolina. And he was only in his late 20s when he came there. Yet another person I'm trying to grow up to be like. A couple of years ago, in an address to doctoral graduates, I commented on the dual perplexity their parents were likely to feel. First is the perplexity expressed in the frequent request, "Now tell me again what it is you do." Does that sound familiar to anyone? The other source of their perplexity is unexpressed, but they're thinking that this is the kid who couldn't find two socks that matched, and now he or she is getting a PhD. Parents, not the only people who have a hard time understanding what folks like us do, but it is important that we understand it. That's not easy, because there's a good chance that what we know and what we do with it keeps changing. And understanding is far more than just knowing stuff. Part of our job as teachers is to help our students and each other understand what they and we are doing, and maybe even be able to explain it to others. Of course, some of us still can't find socks that match, but that's okay. There's a story from my years as a pastor. I'll cut to the punchline. After listening with perplexity to colleagues talk about their approaches to preparing sermons days, sometimes weeks in advance, one of them finally asked, "What do you guys do during the prelude?" This is a story about finding the right balance between careful planning and preparation and remaining flexible and open to new insight. That balance is not easy, but it's central to innovation and discovery, as well as to the responsible practice of our profession. We rely on the achievements of others. We rely on the received knowledge and methods as frameworks and foundations for discovery. And reliance is a form of trust. That framework, far from confining us, makes possible our creativity and freedom of exploration. That is to say that trust is woven into the very fabric of our knowing and understanding. This is part of what it means to belong to a community of scholars, characterized by mutual trust, mutual respect, and mutual accountability. One last allegedly true story. A retired priest used part of his pension each month to make sandwiches for street people with whom he would visit and talk. Word got back to the bishop about what he was doing, so the bishop and some others sent him checks to buy more sandwich ingredients. A few days later, they got the checks back with a concise, but certainly not cryptic, note that said, "Make your own damn sandwiches." Professors are supposed to profess something, and professing something means more than just thinking about it. It means being engaged, practicing our profession. That comes back to commitment, to shared values, and to excellence in the practice of our profession, the lesson from my high school band director. Thank you for this great honor, which I share with my own teachers, even those who didn't know they were teaching me, and with my students who continue to teach me. I hope you will all learn from each other. Practice, prepare, remain faithful to our foundations, but open to new insights from unexpected places. Appreciate and respect the work of others. Maintain your commitment to our profession. And remember to make your own damn sandwiches.
And for our last award, Dr. Robin Taylor Wilson, our chair-elect for the epidemiology section, will be introducing our final recipient.
I'm so delighted today to present the APHA Epidemiology Section's 2010 Wade Hampton Frost Lectureship to Dr. Leonard Syme. I had the honor of first meeting Dr. Syme as a judge at the Young Epidemiology Scholars Competition in Washington, D.C. a few years ago. After only a short conversation, I was impressed by his positive outlook and his infectious enthusiasm for epidemiology as a tool to understand social influences on disease burden. I will first tell you about Dr. Syme's many accomplishments, but more importantly, I will also tell you about his positive influence on his colleagues, on the way they question the underlying reason for health disparities and the distribution of disease within and between populations. I will also tell you about how this relentless search for answers has not only influenced individual investigators, but entire institutions both in the United States and abroad. Dr. Syme is Professor Emeritus of Epidemiology and Community Health at the University of California, Berkeley. His major research interest has been psychosocial risk factors such as job stress, social support, and poverty. In doing this research, he has studied San Francisco bus drivers, Japanese living in Japan, Hawaii, and California, British civil servants, and people living in Alameda County, California. Dr. Syme has written two books and over 160 published papers. He has been a visiting professor at universities in England and Japan. He was elected to the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences and has received several honors related to his teaching and research, among them the Lilienfeld Award for Excellence in Teaching, the J.D. Bruce Award from the American College of Physicians for Distinguished Contributions in Preventive Medicine, and the University of California Distinguished Emeritus Professor Award. Now retired, Dr. Syme is principal investigator of health research for Action Center, which is attempting to empower people and community using printed materials, television, and community resource development. When I contacted a few colleagues to let them know about Dr. Syme's award, I also asked them to share a few words with us today. Dr. George Kaplan, Thomas Francis Collegiate Professor Emeritus of Epidemiology and founder of the Center for Social Epidemiology and Population Health at the University of Michigan, says, and I quote, "Len's tenacity and drive to convince people that social determinants of health do matter is only matched by his great warmth and support for students and colleagues. When you add this to the skills of a great storyteller and an acute observer of the field of epidemiology, it is easy to understand why he has had such an important impact on epidemiology in general and social epidemiology in particular." Dr. Nancy Krieger, a professor of Department in Society and Human Development and Health at Harvard School of Public Health, said, first she sent her regrets that she could not be with us today. She leads a caucus here at APHA, and she had a conflicting session. Dr. Krieger says, quote, "It is wonderful and eminently fitting that Len is being awarded the Wade Hampton Frost Lectureship. Frost, after all, was the first ever professor of epidemiology in the United States, and Len stands as the first sociologist in the U.S. to become a professor of epidemiology. He has influenced a generation of researchers encouraging rigorous research on how social conditions shape population distributions of health, disease, and well-being, and always with an eye toward understanding what creates health and well-being, inequities, and how epidemiologists can, working with others both in and outside of public health, creatively and effectively create change and promote health equity." In 2005, Irene Yen wrote an article entitled "Historical Perspective, S. Leonard Syme's Influence on the Development of Social Epidemiology and Where We Go From There." And I would invite you to read the many quotes in there about his broad influence on many individuals, including Nancy Adler, professor of medical psychology at UC San Francisco, and the director of the Mark and MacArthur Research Network on Socioeconomic Status and Health, as well as Bob Hyatt, Deputy Director, Division of Cancer Control and Population Science at the National Cancer Institute, and he is now at UCSF. I want to share in particular Dr. Norman Anderson from the Office of Behavioral and Social Sciences Research, OBSSR. This was established in 1995. He said, and I quote, "Len's research and that which followed it was the basis of the first ever NIH-wide conference on social determinants of health and illness entitled Toward Higher Levels of Analysis, Promise and Progress on Social Aspects of Illness, which was sponsored by OBSSR. Therefore, we are most delighted to convey upon Dr. Syme today the 2010 Wade Hampton Frost Lectureship Award. Please join me in congratulating Dr. Syme."
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be invited to give the Wade Hampton Frost Lecture, especially when one considers the names of the other 38 people who have previously been honored in this way. The very first winner was a man whose name has come up repeatedly today and who had a profound effect on my thinking and who in many ways shaped my approach to research in the field of epidemiology. In 1972, Dr. Abraham Lilienfeld gave the first Frost Lecture. I met him 10 years before that event took place. In 1960, I became executive secretary of the very first epidemiology study section ever at the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Lilienfeld was the first person who was appointed to serve on the study section. In those days, we were not permitted to call our new review group the epidemiology study section because we were told that word was reserved for the study of infectious diseases. The charge we were given for the new study section was to review research grant proposals dealing not only with infectious diseases, but also, if you can believe it, such diseases as coronary heart disease and cancer and even mental health. Since we couldn't use the word epidemiology, we called the new group human ecology, and that name persisted for 5 years. After I left NIH to do other work, the study section was finally renamed the epidemiology study section. That study section was successful in creating a new field, and Dr. Lilienfeld was the most important and influential member of that group. Here's why. In those days, the study section had only a few research grant applications to review each round, sometimes 5, sometimes 10. In spite of our light workload, the new study section had the dubious distinction of having the lowest approval rate at NIH. We found fault with everything. Nothing was good enough to gain our approval. The variety of disciplines represented in the review group was impressive, and that almost guaranteed that we could rarely reach agreement. We had on the study section a geneticist, a nutritionist, a sociologist, a virologist, a physician, a dentist, a demographer, an epidemiologist, among others. About 1 year after we were in existence, Dr. Lilienfeld spoke up about our poor approval rate, and his comments changed everything. He pointed out to all of us that the study section's low approval rate was in effect destroying the new field of epidemiology rather than building it. Nature, he said, presented us with some very difficult and nasty research challenges. Could we not, he asked, at least be kind to one another? Could we not find a way to encourage the growth of this new discipline instead of finding fault with everything and ensuring its failure? His speech had a major impact on all of us, and it was an important influence in changing our approach and in actually allowing us to award research grants to investigators to do work in the field. Abraham Lilienfeld, the first recipient of the Wade Hampton Frost Lecture, was a hero to me at that time, and he still is. A second, very early recipient of the Frost Lectureship Award was another hero of mine. I have a large picture of him in my office. John Castle gave the fourth Wade Hampton Frost Lecture in 1975. The title of his talk was "The Contribution of the Social Environment to Host Resistance." His lecture was subsequently published in 1976 in the American Journal of Epidemiology, and I still assign that article to students every year. It is to me one of the classic papers in epidemiology. That paper also shaped my thinking at the time, and it still does. In that paper, Dr. Castle noted that while disease agents are ubiquitous in our environment, only some of us get sick, and only some of the time. For this reason, he emphasized the crucial importance of better studies of the factors that influence host resistance. He particularly urged the study of a range of social factors that had not previously been studied sufficiently. In 1979, 3 years later, I co-authored a paper with Lisa Berkman that was also published in the American Journal of Epidemiology. Our paper was titled "Social Networks, Host Resistance, and Mortality." And it was the first paper ever written on the importance of social support and health, and that paper was, of course, directly influenced by John Castle's Frost Lecture. John was influential in my career in another important way. In 1967, a colleague and I organized a conference to discuss the research that was then beginning to deal with the social epidemiology of coronary heart disease. We wanted a meeting to bring together all the investigators in the country who were working on this problem so that we could compare notes. We scoured the country and were able to find 28 people. But John Castle was one of them, and his contribution to that meeting made the whole event worthwhile. So you can see that I come to this Frost Lecture some 35 years later in awe and with a sense of the seriousness of this event. This, for me, is not just another talk. My purpose today will be to reflect back on those early days, discuss some events that I see as significant in our current work, and then offer some thoughts about the future. Specifically, I will offer some thoughts on our need to develop a more appropriate causal model in epidemiology. My first point today deals with my thoughts that we are looking at causality in a way that is both confusing and misleading. Consider the case of coronary heart disease. We say that risk factors for this disease include serum cholesterol, hypertension, cigarette smoking, several other factors such as obesity, diabetes, physical inactivity, we all know the list, without taking into account host or environment. This way of looking at the problem causes puzzling outcomes. It turns out that all of the risk factors for coronary heart disease that we know, considered together, account for less than half of the disease that occurs. It's not that we've missed one or two important risk factors. Those missing risk factors would have to be of enormous significance to account for the 50% of disease not accounted for. It's not likely we would miss risk factors of such importance. And the case of coronary heart disease is not unique. The same problem exists for many other diseases as well. I'm aware of the controversy that exists regarding the 50% statistic, and I'm prepared to debate this issue with those who think the percentage explained is higher than I have claimed. And I suggest the solution to this problem comes from research that's now being done on the social determinants of health. This research has presented its own set of challenging problems. For example, how can we explain the fact that people in lower social class positions have higher rates of not just one, two, or three diseases, but virtually every disease we know about? A few cancers are an exception. On the face of it, this doesn't make biologic sense. It's difficult to explain how one such risk factor could be related to so many diseases. The same phenomenon exists for the concept of social support. A recent review of the literature on social support examined 148 studies involving 308,000 people. That review found that those people who had poor social connections had mortality rates 50% higher over a 7-year follow-up than people with better connections. And that finding involved not just one or two diseases, but a wide range of diseases. And these observations held after account was taken of age, gender, baseline health status. And that same finding is true for many other psychosocial risk factors. So on the one hand, we have a set of disease-specific risk factors that don't satisfactorily explain the diseases they're intended to explain. And on the other hand, a set of psychosocial risk factors that inexplicably are related to virtually all diseases. This puzzle can be explained if we look at disease causation in a new way, in a more appropriate way, in my view, in a two-step model framework. Thus, the argument would go as follows. Psychosocial risk factors are related to host susceptibility. The effect of harmful psychosocial risk factors would be to compromise the body's immune system and make us more vulnerable to disease, but it would not predict which diseases we get. These psychosocial risk factors would not increase the risk of any specific disease, but they would make us vulnerable to disease in general. The specific disease that we get would be attributable to the particular disease agents that one was exposed to. The viruses, the bacteria, the cigarette smoke, the high-fat diets, the air pollution, the stress, and so on. A colleague of mine at Berkeley, Dr. Emily Jacobs, recently showed me some remarkable early data that is supportive of this way of thinking. She studied 113 people of varying racial and ethnic backgrounds and from several social class groups and showed that several important psychosocial variables were related to immune functioning in a very significant way. Specifically, she found that interleukin-6 responses varied in exactly the ways we would have expected with selected psychosocial factors. For those unfamiliar with this protein, interleukin-6 is importantly involved in the immune functioning of the body, and it's related to several diseases, including diabetes, coronary heart disease, rheumatoid arthritis, depression, and prostate cancer. I look forward to her publication of these findings so that we can discuss their implications for the development of a two-step model of disease etiology. I should note also that the recent research on telomere length goes in the same direction and worth another discussion. As I've thought about this issue over the years, I've come to the conclusion that we epidemiologists who study such non-infectious diseases as coronary disease, cancer, asthma, arthritis, are using an inappropriate model of disease causation in our work. Infectious disease epidemiologists have it right. They know that disease agents must be considered in relation to both host susceptibility and environmental circumstances. We epidemiologists who study non-infectious disease tend to study the relationship between risk factors and disease while taking relatively little notice of either host susceptibility or environmental circumstance. So that's point one. A two-stage model of disease causation has important implications for the way we study disease etiology. And this leads me to point two. We in epidemiology tend to study individual diseases using categories that are clearly useful in clinical medicine. Disease categories that clinicians find useful in diagnosing and treating patients. Heart disease, cancer, arthritis. When we epidemiologists use these same categories in our research, it makes it difficult for us to study the fundamental determinants of health in the population. I introduce this idea to beginning students at Berkeley by telling them a made-up story. I tell of a curvy road in the mountains, where at one point cars fall off the cliff at a very high rate. And these cars crash at the bottom, causing very serious damage. Head injuries, spinal cord injuries. And in my story, the medical care at the bottom is not good. As a consequence, people have to be transported long distances, usually by helicopter or ambulance, to get help. Not good. In my story, I suggest we develop a state-of-the-art health promotion and disease prevention program for the road. First, we'll develop a hazard assessment and barrier program that will prohibit certain groups from driving on the road. Certain old people or people with vision and physical problems will be directed to take an alternative road. Those drivers who are permitted to proceed will have to submit to a behavioral intervention, a safe driving class. But we will also develop an environmental intervention by getting car manufacturers to reinforce and strengthen the cars before they can proceed. And we will build a state-of-the-art medical facility at the bottom with musculoskeletal people and neurosurgeons and so on. The new facility will also remove all economic barriers for care so that everyone has universal access. And we will ensure that everyone gets culturally appropriate medical treatment with language translation when necessary. In short, we will do everything that's now being recommended in first-rate health promotion and disease prevention programs. In my classes, someone will eventually raise their hand and quietly ask, "How about fixing the road?" I then attack that person by asking how they can permit the diversion of funds from critically injured and bleeding people to do a highway construction project. Eventually, someone will tentatively suggest that if we don't do the highway work, people will keep falling off the road. We eventually agree that a truly effective health promotion program must take account of the fundamental forces that cause our problems in the first place. But this is difficult because our attention is inevitably drawn to the suffering people lying on the ground. And it's difficult to talk about some vague future prevention program that will be of possible value far off in the future. None of this is to suggest that we ignore those injured people lying on the ground. They clearly need the best medical care they can get. But we epidemiologists have a different mission. Our job is to identify risk factors for disease that will result in the prevention of disease. And that job cannot be done by studying individual diseases. I really struggled with this concept when I began my research on coronary heart disease in 1958. At that time, we knew that mortality rates of CHD were much higher on the east and west coasts of the country and in the Detroit-Chicago industrial area, but that CHD mortality rates were much lower in the rest of the country. After several years of research on this phenomenon, I observed a very strange and upsetting thing. It turned out that states with high coronary heart disease mortality rates also had high all-cause mortality rates. And states with low coronary mortality rates also had low all-cause mortality rates. So states with high rates of CHD were distinctive not for that reason, but because they had high death rates. And low-rate states were remarkable not because of their low CHD rates, but because of their low death rates. Coronary heart disease mortality rates accounted for about 38% of all deaths in all the states. I did that analysis in the early 60s. For the purposes of my talk today, I redid those analyses using current data and found the same proportionate mortality story as I found over 40 years earlier. Death rates from coronary heart disease are, of course, much lower now than they were in the early 60s, but the proportion that coronary heart disease rates relative to all causes of death is still about the same in all states, whether the rates are high or low in that state. Instead of about 38%, the proportionate rate of coronary heart disease now averages about 26% for men and about 24% for women. What is the meaning of these statistics? The meaning to me is that by focusing our attention on such clinical disease categories as coronary heart disease, we are prevented from seeing the larger picture. Why do certain states have high or low death rates? It seemed to me in 1965, and it seems to me now, that our continued focus on one or another particular disease was preventing us from seeing the larger picture. Our focus on trees was limiting our ability to see the forest. I told the story of the curvy road to emphasize the importance of searching for fundamental underlying causes. And I suggested that a more appropriate way to proceed, a more appropriate way than focusing our attention on one or another disease that's merely a consequence of those underlying forces. The curvy road story was a made-up story. Here's a real story illustrating the same point. We've been studying 2,000 bus drivers in San Francisco for many years now. The project started when a former student of mine became director of health for San Francisco City employees. And as part of her job, she supervised the physical exam for the bus drivers when they got their driving licenses renewed. She called me one day to say that she thought the prevalence of hypertension was too high in this group, and would I come and have a look? I did, and she was right. Among drivers over the age of 60, the prevalence of hypertension was 90%. So we applied for a research grant to study this problem in detail. We did all the things you would imagine, and we wrote several journal articles about the problem. Then we began to develop an intervention program to help the drivers. Then we noticed that the drivers were complaining about a lot of back pain. We got another grant to study this problem, and we wrote several journal articles about that, and we brought in some ergonomic people to help redesign the driver's seats and so on. Then we noticed that the drivers had high rates of gastrointestinal problems and respiratory difficulties, and later we observed that they have high rates of alcohol problems after work, not while they're driving. And we got research grants for everything, and we designed interventions for all of these problems, and while what we were doing was not a waste of time, it certainly was not going to solve the problem for the drivers. For example, even if we did a wonderful job on the blood pressures and the back pain and the stomach problems and the breathing difficulties and the drinking issue, as new drivers came to work for the bus company, they would soon exhibit the same disease profile as the old drivers because none of our work was addressing the fundamental problem. The fundamental problem was the job itself. We got so focused on various specific disease problems of the drivers that we didn't recognize the problem common to all of the complaints, the job. We therefore began a new project to see if we could figure out what it is about the job of bus driving that's problematic. It didn't take long to discover the problem. It's the schedule. In San Francisco, drivers must keep to the schedule, but it can't be done. For example, if you look at the schedule, you'd see you had to get from Mission and Army to Mission and Geneva in 2 minutes. It can't be done. Even if you drove your Ferrari on Sunday morning and picked up no one, it takes longer than 2 minutes. I always thought a bus schedule was made by driving a bus from stop to stop and seeing how long it takes. That's okay if you have lots of buses available, but there's a shortage of buses in San Francisco, and the schedule is therefore made by a computer that simply allocates the times depending on the number of buses that are available. Then the drivers are penalized when they're late in arriving at the bus stop. The drivers compensate for this by giving up their rest stops at the end of the line. They just keep driving and hope to minimize their lateness in this way. They dash into a McDonald's when they need to use the bathroom and when they need food. And since they're almost always late, passengers are almost always mad at them. The drivers feel that they're being unjustifiably blamed for a situation that's not in their control, and they sometimes behave impolitely to passengers, who then get upset with the driver and so on. And most drivers have a terrible shift arrangement. They must come to work very early in the morning rush hour, must be at work for the evening rush hour, but they have nothing to do in the hours between the two intervals. There's generally not enough time to go home, so the drivers generally hang around and do little. At the end of their very long day, they're usually completely worn out, and many go to the local tavern to wind down. By the time they get home, they're often not in good shape for social interaction. They go to bed and get up at 4 a.m. to begin another grueling day. Yes, they have hypertension and back pain and stomach and breathing and alcohol problems, and they should be helped with those problems. But the job needs to be fixed. Once again, work in infectious diseases is instructive. The fundamental disease classification scheme used in the consideration of infectious diseases included such categories as waterborne diseases, airborne diseases, vector-borne disease, and foodborne disease. Classifying diseases in this way is not helpful to clinicians in the diagnosis and treatment of sick people, but it is entirely relevant if we're interested in the prevention of those diseases. These categories tell us where disease is coming from and where to direct intervention efforts. This system of disease categorization is exactly appropriate to the public health mission. The clinical categories are not. In the study of non-infectious diseases, we don't have a good set of categories equivalent to water, air, food, and vector. Several years ago, we applied for a grant from the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention to study fifth grade children living in a low-income community near Berkeley. The CDC had invited grant applications that would focus on cigarette smoking and other drugs, violence, poor school performance, inappropriate sexual behavior, and so on. But when we sent in our application, we said that we had decided not to study any of those things. This is not a strategy I recommend to others. We decided instead to focus on the fundamental issues underlying all of these problems. We decided to focus on hope. We based this decision on our interviews with many of these young people, in which they told us they didn't think they would live beyond the age of 20. Our view was that if these children, mostly from minority groups and mostly from very poor families, had no hope for the future, what difference would it make if they smoked or used drugs or missed school or engaged in violent behavior? So we decided to work on hope and to help these children see that they could have a future. CDC received over 400 proposals from all over the country, and I was amazed that they rated our proposal number one in the country, even though we broke the rules. So it can be done. In our work with these children, we decided over a three-year period to teach them ways of implementing their dreams, how to make things work for their benefit, how to select a problem and succeed in solving it, how to develop strategies for getting done what they want to get done, for having control over their destiny. These children are not very interested in talking about smoking or drugs or violence, our topics, but they can become interested in their future. The people we chose to work with them were high school students from their community, along with selected undergraduates from the University of Berkeley. We did a wonderful job with these kids for 3 years. I would love to follow them into the future, but where would I get money to do that? The Centers for Disease Control has moved on to other interests, and most other funding agencies remain interested in specific diseases and individual risk factors such as obesity and diabetes, not a topic like hope. To this point, I've suggested that our causal model in epidemiology is deficient because we have not recognized that a two-step model is necessary in our work, a model that focuses not only on disease risk factors, but one that recognizes host susceptibility as well. That was point one. Then I suggested point two, that to truly understand host susceptibility, we need to recognize the need for a new way, a more appropriate way of classifying diseases. A classification for non-infectious diseases equivalent to the one we use in the study and prevention of infectious diseases. What would that classification look like? I can think of a category of disease that might be termed poverty diseases, or another that might be referred to as nutritional deficiency diseases. Or how about a category called discrimination diseases? If one were actually to use such a classification scheme, to which institute at the NIH would our proposal be sent? The reality is that NIH wouldn't know what to do with the proposal. There has, until now, been no institute at the National Institutes of Health that can easily accommodate such categories. Even such institutes as the National Institute of Mental Health, or the National Institute of Child Growth and Human Development, or the National Institute of Aging, or the National Institute of Environmental Health Science, tend to be focused on very specific clinical programs in their area of concern. Our proposal would not easily fit into any of these institutes. Until very recently, the NIH has been organized around clinical diseases and not around epidemiologically relevant, prevention-oriented categories. Actually, things are not really as bad as I'm suggesting. Things are now getting better. NIH is moving towards a more interdisciplinary stance, and the new Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities is a major step forward in this regard. In addition to these changes at NIH, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has established a postdoctoral training program called Health and Society that is explicitly aimed at transcending disciplinary silos. They only support 18 fellows a year, but it's a beginning. And Canada is providing a good example as well. A few years ago, the Canadian government was considering the establishment of NIH for Canada. Many of us warned them that if they patterned their NIH along the lines of our NIH, it would be a major setback to the cause of disease prevention. They did establish a Canadian Institute for Health Research, and they did set up a whole series of institutes focusing, as we do, on heart disease and cancer and arthritis, but they also established an Institute of Population Health, an Institute on Gender, and an Institute on Aboriginal Health. I served for 5 years on the Population Health Advisory Board, and it's hard to communicate the difference it makes when one can concentrate on population health without the restraint of having to relate everything to one or another disease. We must somehow come to recognize that the clinical, individually oriented tradition runs strong in this country and that it limits our ability to think in population terms. Another step forward. We recently applied for a large grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to develop an intervention to improve the level of social capital in a very low-income community with high rates of virtually all diseases. The goal of this project is to help people connect with one another, to realize that they have interests in common, and to help them work together for the common good. The foundation wanted to know what our disease outcomes would be. Or, if we're not going to look at disease outcomes, whether we'd be studying changes in such health-related behaviors as smoking and obesity. These are, of course, entirely reasonable questions. Our response to the foundation was that we would be examining none of these traditional outcomes. We would instead monitor such things as changes in trust, engagement, and civic participation. We would be assessing changes in the fundamental social forces that underlie the poor health statistics and the high-risk behavior. Our argument to them was that if we merely focused on one or another disease, or one or another health-related behavior, and if we neglected the community social forces that were causing the problems in the first place, we would not be helping to improve the circumstances of people in the community. And we were successful in getting that grant. Of course, the grant was not awarded through the normal foundation divisions, but under the category of pioneering grants. So while I'm complaining about the current state of epidemiology funding, there are signs that things are improving. To summarize the 2 points I've tried to make so far, I've suggested that our causal model in epidemiology is deficient because we haven't recognized that a two-step model is necessary in our work, a model that focuses not only on disease-specific risk factors, but one that recognizes host susceptibility as well. Then I suggested that to truly understand host susceptibility, we needed to recognize the need for a new way, a more appropriate way of classifying disease, a classification for non-infectious diseases equivalent to the one used in the study and prevention of infectious diseases. I would now like to introduce a third point that will be useful in developing a more appropriate causal model in epi, the need for a better understanding of biological processes. A colleague recently suggested to me that our work in social epidemiology was doomed to failure. And I think his point is relevant for other subdisciplines in epidemiology as well. He said that we study a concept such as social class without knowing what we mean by this term and without knowing how to measure it. Then the disease outcomes we study have taken years to develop and are the result of many influences that are far beyond our intellectual grasp. He said that the same problem exists for such other mysterious concepts as social support, social capital, hostility, and so on. He wondered how we could possibly build a science on such a shaky foundation. His suggestion was that we stop focusing on disease outcomes and instead look at biological markers for these diseases, markers that are more proximally related to the predictor variables. By looking at the relationship between these markers and predictors, we will be able to use the markers as criterion variables that will help us better refine our understanding and measurement of the predictors. This is not to suggest that we focus on the biological markers in their own right. The suggestion is that we use these markers only to help us better define what we mean by words like hope and social class and social support. By identifying the important elements involved in these concepts in this way, we'll be better able to develop interventions aimed at them. My colleague Laura Gottlieb, who I think I saw in the audience, yes, she's here, has criticized my suggestion that we do a better job of understanding biological process. She said that she understands my intention to not focus attention on the biological markers per se, but that we instead use them only to help us better understand social factors. But she argues that it probably won't work out that way. She said that the identification of a biological marker such as interleukin-6 will probably set us back in our efforts to develop a more appropriate prevention agenda. She fears that a finding such as interleukin-6 will simply provide the drug companies with a perfect opportunity to develop a drug to fix the problem, and that will be the result of this important research. I responded by saying that we can't censor our research because of what the bad guys might do. But I haven't slept easily since she made these comments, and her point is something I think we should all think about and talk more seriously than we have to date. I'd like now to add a fourth suggestion to my list of ideas that will lead to a more relevant causal model for epidemiology. This fourth suggestion comes from the recent article by Professor Lisa Berkman in the Annual Review of Public Health. In that article, Berkman noted that there's a discrepancy between the results we obtain in our epidemiologic research and the success we have in interventions based on that research. For example, we note in our research that people with poor social connections have higher rates of certain diseases. We then design an intervention to improve social connections to show that those in the experimental group will have better health outcomes than those in the control group. Most often than that, our interventions fail to show the results we had hoped for. Berkman suggests that many of these failures have occurred because we haven't paid sufficient attention to critical periods in the life cycle. We intervene on risk factors at one time in people's lives, even though those risk factors may have been established and set in place many years earlier. She suggests that more attention needs to be devoted, one, identifying the correct etiologic period within a life course perspective, and two, understanding the dynamic interplay between interventions and the social, economic, and environmental contexts in which interventions are delivered. Good advice. All of these suggestions, the need to recognize the importance of host susceptibility in the etiology of disease, the need to develop a more appropriate disease classification scheme that will be more relevant for prevention, the need for a better understanding of biological processes to help us better define predictor variables, and the need to be cognizant of critical periods in the lifespan, all of these will help us develop a more useful causal model for epidemiology, a more useful model for understanding disease causation and disease prevention. Nothing I have said, of course, is to suggest that we stop studying diseases one at a time. Of course we need to continue that work, but I am suggesting that we also pay more attention to the cause of causes. These suggestions are made with a sense of urgency. Beginning this year, as we all know, the baby boomer population is beginning to enter the over 65 population. By the year 2030, the number of people over the age of 65 in this country will almost be double what it is today. If we think our medical care resources are strained now, we ain't seen nothing yet. It's hard to imagine that the expansion of medical care resources that will be needed to care for this greatly enlarged and needy population. To deal with this crisis, it seems clear to me that we will need to help people enter the over 65 population in a healthier condition than is now the case. And to do that, we will need to improve our approach to disease prevention and health promotion. And to do that, we will require an epidemiology that is more appropriately attuned to the fundamental forces that affect health. A continued focus on individual behavior and individual risk factors will not do the job. Public health has a long and distinguished history of cleaning our water, protecting our food, cleaning our air, controlling mosquitoes and other disease vectors. We now need to expand that mission by learning better ways of influencing a broader set of determinants of health and disease. Since I began work in this field 50 years ago, the improvements we have made in our approach to these issues are astonishing. In the days of the human ecology study section, we never saw work of the quality that is in evidence today. And I'm optimistic that work in the next 50 years will be even more impressive, especially if we can free ourselves to think more imaginatively about causal models. I wish us all the best in this important mission. Thank you.